Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, reporting on the latest stories going on nationally in African American and Black society. At 9, Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire, connecting history with current events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Radio Zine, offering a variety of intriguing public affairs programming. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hello, and welcome back to Rural Roots Rising by the Rural Organizing Project. If this is your first time listening, Rural Roots Rising is a monthly radio show and podcast created by and for rural Oregonians who are creatively and courageously building stronger and more vibrant communities for a just democracy. My name is Jess Campbell, and I'm the director of the Rural Organizing Project. This month's episode is Taking Risks. Today we'll hear from Suzanne Farr, a renowned community organizer and movement elder, and Zachary Stocks, whose passion to make museums dynamic spaces accessible to everyone brought him into community organizing. We begin this episode with Suzanne Farr, an inspiring community organizer whose decades-long career includes co-founding the Arkansas Women's Project and writing the books Homophobia, A Weapon of Sexism, and In the Time of the Right. Suzanne shared some about how she politically came of age.
I think I was so very lucky, I and other people who sort of came of age, and when I say came of age, I'm talking about in our 30s, in the 70s, because we had a very vibrant women's movement, and part of that movement was a very strong women of color, particularly Black lesbians. There was Combahee River Collective. They put forth their great Combahee River Collective statement, which was about intersectionality. It moved around the women's movement. It was followed by extraordinary intersectional multiracial things like Sweet Honey in the Rock with their gorgeous and political music.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Like Kitchen Table Press, which published just book after book after book by women of color. It was multiracial and multi-issue.
Till the killing of Black men, Black mothers' sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers' sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Suzanne went on to co-found the Women's Project in Arkansas as a multiracial, multi-generational organization whose goal was to eliminate systemic racism, sexism, and economic injustice. The Women's Project work ranged from disability justice to tracking far-right groups threatening communities, and always pushing the envelope about what conversations needed to be started so real systemic change could be made.
That and the fact we were scrappy, that we were willing to take on new ideas, we were willing to pivot, and we were willing to stand every time we saw, I saw things that other people weren't addressing. One of our first commitments was that we would take on the work that other people were scared to do or reluctant to do so that they would get accustomed to it and move in and take it over, and we would move to the next thing. We were well set in the way we thought about things, the way we trained each other, the way we studied, the way we worked, that we could take on things. And we also thought that we could take risk and that we should take risk.
One of the most inspiring Women's Project undertakings was the formation of the Women's Watch Care Network that documented violence toward women, folks of color, Jewish people, and KKK activity across the state of Arkansas.
Yeah, I think our best example maybe of intersectionality is our work with the murders of women. And it didn't start out that way. It started out that we were seeing Black people killed. We were seeing Jewish cemeteries just painted all over, you know, spray painted all over. We were seeing the horrors of what was happening to women. Of course, we were seeing the horrors of what was happening to LGBT people. So we decided to start a project to monitor that. So the Methodist women have been our friends. They have been so good to us over the years. And they gave us a little grant, and we decided to monitor what was going on. We didn't know how to attack what was going on, but we knew that we could monitor it, and then we could organize around that. So we called it the Women's Watch Care Network. And the way we set it up was we always had an absolute commitment to rural places, even though we were located in Little Rock. And so over half our board was always rural. We drove out into rural areas to do our work, to do our organizing, so, you know, to make it real. So we thought we would set up groups around the state in places where we've done work, and that we'd ask that group to be at least four people representing each of the groups that was experiencing hate violence. So at least, you know, one woman who experienced violence, a gay person, a person of color, someone who's Jewish, and that they make a basically a story circle, and that they tell their story. And so what came out of that, and we had them all around the state, what came out of that is that people recognize that their stories were alike, you know? Not the exact event, but the violence, the nature of the violence, the trauma of the violence. We knew that people were going to give us holy hell if we reported the results of those stories without documentation. So we asked people to send us any paper documentation they had. This is before you were taking things offline. We said any newspaper article, statistics of being women being killed, any Klan flyers that are on the cars in front of Walmart, you know, the Klan, they love to do churches and Walmart and places like that, put all those flyers out. Take them and mail them to us. Clip them out. Be sure they have the date on them. Mail them to us. And at one point, we had over 200 groups doing that around the state.
The Women's Project work of meticulously documenting and reporting out about the breadth and significance of the crisis of violence against women led to massive education and awareness raising both locally and nationally. Their work and the collective work of the larger women's movement built the momentum that moved the FBI to include violence against people based on their gender and gender identity as hate crimes.
One of the things that was great in my life at that time, I don't think it was in everybody's, but people were really movement-oriented and weren't holding on to information. You know, it wasn't like you had an ownership of something because you did it in a little town in Arkansas, you know? It was like, so we did this and it worked, and we were connected to the Center for Democratic Renewal, so we had a national organization that was working hate violence that we could be related to. I could see how that would transfer, because you sit around and you share, this is the way I'm doing it, you know, or this is the way this whole group is doing it. And if you're movement oriented, you focus in that, you're going to share that stuff as wide as you can. If you're nonprofit oriented, you're going to hold it to your chest.
Like the Women's Project work of raising awareness and creating space for others to join the conversation, Zachary Stock started Oregon Horse to support rural museums to become spaces for their communities to discuss the issues that matter most. Zachary is the new executive director of Oregon Black Pioneers, whose mission is to research, recognize, and commemorate the culture and heritage of African Americans in the state of Oregon. Before Zachary was at Oregon Black Pioneers, he was part of ROP's first rural organizing fellowship, where he created Oregon Horse, which is short for Heritage Organizations for Rural Social Equity. Oregon Horse is a grassroots network of rural museums and heritage organizations across Oregon committed to using local histories and their place in their communities to create learning spaces that are safe and welcoming for all.
So my background is working in museums. That's what I've done most of my career. And I always knew that I wanted to work in museums ever since I was a little kid. And so my specialty was sort of working around the history of the United States in the 1700s. And so there weren't very many places on the West Coast where I could work and get to, to share that history and do interpretation around that history. But I was working for an organization that had historic ships, including one of the ships that was in the fleet of the Columbia Rediviva. So I had that chance to live in Astoria and to tell that history from there, and it was really great. And so for me, with my fellowship project, I knew I wanted to do something to advance human dignity through my own job. And I feel that everyone in society has a responsibility to do something to help their friends and neighbors, especially their friends and neighbors of color, right? Because those are the ones that are most systemically disenfranchised or face the greatest risk of deportation, discrimination, homophobia. Every problem basically that can happen in our society is amplified if you're a person of color. And as a person of color working in museums, I've seen firsthand how I don't feel represented by our history museums. I don't feel like my history is on display very often. And it made me sad. And so when I found out about this fellowship, I knew I wanted to apply because I'd been looking for ways that I could try to make a difference. But I didn't know if ROP would be interested in me being a fellow because I don't have a background in organizing. I had sort of a vision about museums as places where community members could gather to talk about important issues to them. And I was really glad that ROP also thought that that was a good idea, because it led to the development of, you know, my project.
Zachary traveled the state meeting with museum staff and volunteers in rural communities in every corner of Oregon, and took the time to get to know the community each museum was rooted in. Zachary's trips around the state were a way of getting out there, meeting people, and understanding local needs on a deeper level, so Zachary could support the local museums making the pushes they needed to truly represent the entire community.
I had to do a lot of community outreach. So because I was a traveling employee, I spent a lot of time on the road, and I had the opportunity to visit a lot of towns in the Pacific Northwest, and that included a lot of rural towns on the coast. And so I met people, and I would hear the things that they cared about, the things that they were passionate about. I would see where in town was thriving and also who was at a disadvantage. And I also saw the economic instability that happens through a lot of rural America, you know, downtowns that aren't doing well. But people, no matter how the town is doing, people have a lot of pride in their museums. So to me, when I got the fellowship, I started putting into practice some of that community outreach work as organizing work. I started thinking about how those were really similar things. I would just have conversations with people about the things that they thought were the biggest issues in their town. You know, if you live there, I would want to know, what are the things that keep you up at night? What bothers you? What do you think should change? And who should be part of that change? I remember I went to Joseph, Oregon, way out east, and I asked the director of the Maxville Heritage Interpretive Center, what is the most pressing issue in town that you think you have, that your institution can help address? And I was thinking she might say something like militias or the impact of tourism or something like that. She said wolves. I wasn't ready for that. But that's the reality in rural America, right? Like, you know, out here in Oregon, it is wild sometimes. And the things that people are concerned about are not the same things that people are concerned about in urban areas or even in other rural areas in Oregon. There's no wolf problem in Clatsop County, I can tell you that.
The people and institutions that hold our community's history make decisions every day about which stories get attention and which are downplayed. The work of the Women's Watch Care Network and the museums within Oregon Horse are examples of democratizing whose stories are told, how those stories are told, and who the audiences should be. Talking about the tough issues in rural communities can be risky sometimes, from wolves to pipelines and beyond. Despite being interested in Oregon Horse, Zachary found some museums weren't willing to take the risk.
There were some museums that outright were not interested in participating. I think that they were afraid of the backlash of what was going to happen if they were honest and really took steps to make sure that, you know, they were actually living up to the accountability standards that museums are supposed to have. Because if you're a public institution and a highly visible one like a museum, you really need to be a part of your community beyond just having your doors open and letting people walk inside. They need to be helping you create your exhibition content. They need to feel safe there. And I think that you should give back in that way by making sure that if there's something that's really important going on in town and people are vulnerable, that you are there for them. And you can get the community together to talk about those issues and find out what the solutions might be.
Unlike cities where there are enough people where you can maintain some level of anonymity, in small towns and rural communities, everyone knows everyone. The impact of becoming a target can include losing your entire social community, your job, or your physical safety. That's why Zachary built a cohort of museums and heritage organizations to support each other. And that's why the Women's Project built the multi-regional Women's Watch Care Network to document and prove that there truly was a crisis. Suzanne's work with the Women's Project brought her out to Oregon to work on the No on 9 campaign. Led by the Oregon Citizens Alliance, Ballot Measure 9 would have rewritten Oregon's constitution to legalize discrimination against LGBTQ+ people, suggesting that they were a threat to society and children in particular. The measure proclaimed, quote, "Gays, lesbians, bisexuals, necrophiliacs, and pedophiles are abnormal and perverse." A cornerstone of the campaign was the notion that queer people were somehow receiving special rights by having their civil rights recognized. Does this sound familiar to conversations happening now, y'all? They say history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes.
That's where we came up with the term wedge issues across the country. And that was an effort to wedge people apart. And so that was part of the group evangelicals who moved that concept. And so by the time we got to 1992, it felt like out of the blue came this idea that we would have ballot initiatives, both in Oregon and in Colorado, to prohibit the involvement of the LGBTQ community in any participation of reception of civil rights, as well as from participation in things like being able to teach, you know, to sort of isolate out of the community. And so it was held together by using the messaging of David Duke, the Grand Dragon of the KKK for years and years and years, which was to link gay rights with special rights, so that and to link special rights with the idea that their civil rights, and then these are people who are asking for special rights beyond civil rights. And the goal of that was to begin to erode the concept of what civil rights are, and also to be able to set up a basis for civil rights that is the idea of you're earning them, you know, that deserving people got civil rights and those who weren't deserving would not. And so this was a great way to work on with racism as to figure out how to start wedging off people in terms of their civil rights by just holding that identification, civil rights, special rights. So that's what the campaign was about. And Oregon rose up, and it was an extraordinary rising up of people in the state through organizing, not just by putting the call out, through very, very hard and very good organizing on lots and lots of fronts. And we were also recognizing at that time that this effort to narrow who gets rights and to start moving harder and harder, this idea there's not enough to go around, there's a sense of scarcity out there. If somebody gets rights, you're going to lose your rights, or your rights are not going to be big enough. We also recognized at that time is they were plowing the ground for attacking immigrants and immigration. And sure enough, it moved hard right out of that and has been moving hard ever since.
While the campaign seeking to defeat Ballot Measure 9 focused their energy on winning in Portland and other cities, the Oregon Citizens Alliance was building a rural base by working with a network of churches and collecting signatures at community hubs. At the time, Marcy Westerling was working at the Columbia County Women's Resource Center and had connections with people in every county in Oregon working to support survivors of domestic violence. Rural leaders were hungry to organize a resistance movement to bigotry, and Marcy was ready to organize a network of groups scattered across the state to share resources, strategies, tactics, and to break rural isolation, inspired by none other than the Women's Project. With the help of Suzanne Farr, Scott Nakagawa, and Pat McGuire, they hit the road across rural Oregon together to see what was possible, and the Rural Organizing Project was born.
And so Marcy had this great commitment to rural people. And I had this great commitment to rural people, that I was born and raised in the South on a farm. I never lost that deep devotion to and commitment to rural people. And so she had this idea that we could actually move something or build something that would work with rural people to raise consciousness and involvement in the community. And so her idea was what became the Rural Organizing Project. So she and I and Scott Nakagawa and Pat McGuire were part of the parties who talked a lot about it. There were other people as well. But we got in my little 1981 Honda wagon and drove around the state to talk to people, to see sort of who was out there. It was quite a little crowd. It was a little car and a very fun and wonderful foursome. And we thought that was a critical thing to do, was to see both who's there and possible.
We are the ones, we are the ones, we've been waiting.
And so it evolved out of that. And I always think it was symbolic that in that car, that little wagon, taking that first trip out, it was two people of color and two white people who got in that car and made the trip. I think that very trip was indicative of the dream of ROP. To get out to the country, the rural towns, talk to the people, be multiracial, be multi-issue. Gear up, because this is what's coming.
We are the ones, we've been waiting.
We are the ones,
we're
The success of Oregon Horse was because Zachary went to rural communities, talked to people, and truly listened to what they wanted most for their family and their neighbors. Marcy would often say the ability to truly listen is the most important organizing skill an organizer can have. What Zachary found is that many rural museums are already doing the work that some urban museums are still scratching their heads at.
I learned that museums are already thinking about this work, and they do care about their communities, and they do believe that they should be representative organizations for the people that live in their towns, and that they're just looking for the tools. And I've been visiting a lot of conferences lately, and many, many museums and museum organizations are talking about these same things, but all of them are happening in urban spaces. So I'm glad to be out here working with these museums to advocate for all the hard work that takes place in rural museums to make their communities better, more livable, safer places. Because in a lot of ways, I feel that rural communities are already doing the work that urban cities have been looking for. You know, they say, oh, well, what is the field going to do to be better about inclusive practice? Or how can museums as a field do more to develop programs for their, you know, for their audiences? Well, rural museums have been doing this work, and no one has bothered to ask them. And the ones that haven't done this work, they didn't have the professional development and tools to be able to do this with support. And so that's what I've been trying to provide. So to me, that's what organizers do. So I think that a lot of people are afraid of or don't know that they are organizers because they've never used that language of it, you know, but they actually do the work of it all the time. And so that's one thing that I've had to learn through this fellowship is that a lot of the things that I thought that I didn't know anything about, I actually did. It's just I didn't call it organizing or I didn't use the language of organizing. I was really pushed against the limits of what I thought my comfort zone was and my own abilities, and was pleasantly surprised to see that I had more flexibility than I knew I did.
For more information on Oregon Horse, the Women's Project, the Rural Organizing Fellowship, Ballot Measure 9, and the Combahee River Collective, check out ruralrootsrising.org. Do you have reactions, questions, or ideas about what you just heard? Email us at info@ruralrootsrising.org. We featured music from Sweet Honey in the Rock, Truvai, and the Rhodes Sodas. Additional support for the creation of this episode came from Brenda Flores. Thank you. Rural Roots Rising is created by the Rural Organizing Project, a network of more than 65 autonomous groups who are committed to human dignity and advancing democracy across rural Oregon. Rural Roots Rising is created by the Rural Organizing Project, a network of more than 65 autonomous groups who are committed to human dignity and advancing democracy across rural Oregon. To learn more about the Rural Organizing Project, go to ROP.org. If you liked what you heard today, you can find more episodes at ruralrootsrising.org. Please subscribe to Rural Roots Rising wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.
There may be hope, maybe even for us. We need a lot more people raising a ruckus. Start making a fuss, start giving up. And get out into the streets and there may be hope. There's a time and a place for peace, a time to be ready to bleed. There's a time to play nice and say please, but right now's the time for dismantling machinery. And there may be hope, maybe even for us. We need a lot more people raising a ruckus. Start making a fuss, start giving up, and get out into the streets. And there may be hope. I know the future looks grim. It's a long shot and the margins are slim. But if we stand aside, we'll lose anyway. So I'll go down swinging and be able to say that there may be hope, maybe even for us. We need a lot more people raising a ruckus. Start making a fuss, start giving up, and get out. day or the dead of the night, and if the police get in our way, we're gonna show them. Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. Robert Anton Wilson once wrote, "Perspective, use it or lose it." On this edition of Free Culture Radio, we talk with someone about drugs from a health perspective, then we hear someone talk about drugs from a counterterrorism perspective. I'm on the line with Haven Wheelock. She coordinates the Syringe Services Program at Outside In, a Portland service agency, and holds a master's in public health from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in Baltimore. She's also a chief petitioner for Initiative Petition 44 on Oregon's general election ballot in 2020.